Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking COVID-19, but kind of a lot broader than that, I hope. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and a man who looks like Martin, like it is summer. Why are you wearing a Russian winter jacket?
Yeah, I suffer from the cold, Tony. I feel it now.
That's hearted.
What's going to warm me up is we have another live show tomorrow, and I'm really looking forward to this one. Tony will put the details at the end of this so you can all have a little read. I'm really, really looking forward to it. Look, we're keeping this project on the road. Thanks, everybody, for coming on board who's with us. Please become a patron, Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/tortoiseshack, and I know Tony's going to give me a cheer for getting that right.
Thanks. He's very smooth, isn't he? He's really practiced. You can tell how hard he works at this. Oh God, I get a twitch in my eye just listening to you. Much more importantly, we are delighted to be joined by the Irish Rule of Law's Country Program Manager in Malawi, Shona Dylan McLaughlin. Thank you so much for taking this time for fitting us in. This has got to be a bizarre situation, even in the grand scheme of, like, first of all, do you want to tell our listeners who Irish Rule of Law are and what they do?
Absolutely, Tony. Thank you so much to both of you for having me on. It's an honour. Let me explain who Irish Rule of Law International is. Firstly, it is quite of a tongue tie.
Yeah.
I'll refer to it as Irish Rule of Law, even though that's still a tongue tie, but that might make things a bit smoother. But Irish Rule of Law is a joint initiative of the Law Society and Bar of both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Mm. So it has that cross-border link. Our aim is to promote rule of law in developing countries, and we utilize the skills of the Irish legal profession and beyond to Ireland to share learning and to basically improve access to justice in a number of different countries. So IRLI has had programs and different initiatives in Tanzania, in Zambia, in South Africa, in Kosovo, in Myanmar, and Malawi. And so Malawi is where I'm based. Malawi is our kind of biggest and more established program where there is long-term people like on the ground. Mm. So I'm the country program manager and I have an amazing team of program lawyers who work on the program as well.
Yeah, well, it sounds such a big thing, but I always go back to what, unless you can attest a right, you don't have it. Is that a fair statement of when we talk about law, where, you know, you say, well, there are these laws that are set down, but access to law means that you effectively they're just words on a page. Go on, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think particularly in a country like Malawi and some of the developing countries, that is a part of the challenge. And so, I mean, IRLI has been working in Malawi for 10 years. Mm. And really what we're doing is we're improving access to justice for unrepresented vulnerable people. I can talk through what that actually means, but I suppose there is that specific objective of these individuals and it's promoting their like due process rights and bringing them through that journey through the criminal justice system. And then I suppose what we also do then at a wider trying to effect systematic change within the criminal justice sector. And so then we can get it at both levels, because you have a lot of people in Malawi who will get caught up within the criminal justice system. The majority of people in Malawi are extremely poor, and unfortunately it does have a tagline of being one of the poorest countries in the world, as well as having a very fortunate tagline of being the warm heart of Africa. But as a result of this, there's a lot of people who are poor. Their level of education might be at best primary, so their knowledge and awareness of their own rights is also quite limited. And then in addition to this, you have a criminal justice system that is poorly resourced. Mm. And then that's throughout that's throughout the whole chain within the criminal justice sector. So we're lucky enough that we have program lawyers who are like, they're embedded in the different institutions of the criminal justice sector in Malawi. So they work with local actors within Malawi Police Service, within the judiciary, within the Directorate of Public Prosecutions, and with a department called Legal Aid. So it's a government department. It's basically free legal aid, the equivalent that you would have in Ireland. And we also have then an alternative justice program, which is looking at children who come in conflict with the law. So with that, the mostly unrepresented accused, we're looking to see how we can make this journey a better journey and making sure that we're promoting rule of law and that they do have access to justice.
That's a phenomenally broad, areas to be involved in. It's like, I mean, I don't want to be so flippant about it, but only a few weeks ago, I didn't know you guys existed. And here I am now talking to you, and I did a bit of due diligence and read some bits. But when I think about it in the full context, when you lay it out there, in the context of a poor developing country, it has to be access to justice plus, as you said, reform. How do you find the you know, obviously we always say we, for example, we do a lot of things with people about drug related incidents, and we talk about how you can't just pick up the Lisbon model and drop it in Dublin. It might not work in terms of, you know. So do you find that's what you come up against, that, you know, it has to be locally tailored?
Absolutely. And I think that is key. There is no way that now we have like a mix of lawyers coming from, you know, Ireland, from Canada, from the US, from Malawi as well. Am I missing anyone there? No, the rest then are Irish. So we don't come in saying this is a solution that comes from Ireland, from our jurisdiction. You just can't. So it's all about relationship building to begin with. And we have been there for, in Malawi, we've been here for quite some time. So we've built up that reputation as an organization that comes in and says, okay, what are the challenges as you see them? And the program lawyers work with the local actors on the ground to say, okay, well, what is it? And we don't say, well, this is the training that you need. So a lot of the work would be like training. So training on child justice issues, training on even basic legal concepts, training on gender-based violence. And this would be then catered for the, whether it's the magistrates, whether you're talking to police officers, whether it's lawyers within legal aid or lawyers within the DPP's office. And we don't actually like necessarily give the training. We work with individuals within those institutions to do the training for us. And we're just there as, I suppose, technical assistance and a bit of a just an outside. It can be easier for people inside the institution who want to make change for us to be there as a little bit of leverage to be like, maybe we could do it this way. And if we came with an attitude of we know best, it just wouldn't work. And it can't work because the resources also, you have to work with what resources are. So when we are trying to create reform, it can be slow. It also is about mind change. It's a slow process and you have to come from it at a kind of a bottom-up approach.
And you were talking about it's built upon relationships. That takes an awful lot of commitment from you and those who work with you. It means that you have to be on the ground. You can't be swapping in and out faces every, 2 to 3 months. It means you have to be there for a substantial amount of time. How does that work funding-wise? And you've mentioned funding.
So our organization is lucky enough to have had great funders. At the moment, we have funding from the Irish government. So the Irish Embassy here funds us directly. We had funding from the European Union. And also in the past, we've had some private funders, Human Dignity Foundation. So, and that's, and then also within the Dublin office, they will be fundraising also privately. Yeah. But, you know, donors, like small donors at an individual level, and all that is kind of put together. So it does require a lot of funding, because you have to have a lot of staff on the ground for a long period of time in order to be able to create change. Because I think you can do things, you know, bringing people in and out at a short-term basis, but you have to be realistic then as to what you can achieve.
Yes,
And that's how actually Irish Rule of Law in Malawi, that's actually how we started, was just short-term basis, supporting bail applications for individuals and doing it that way. And then it just grew into a program, because we realized, oh, we can't just focus on one aspect of the criminal justice system. We need to have a holistic approach.
A systematic approach to the whole thing. Yeah. So how long have you been there at this present time yourself?
Well, I've been with Irish Rule of Law since last December, so relatively new. But I've been in Malawi for about 4 years. And previously I was working with the Irish Embassy. So I was actually on the funding side of Irish Rule of Law. So I've been quite familiar with the programme. Malawi is my second home here.
The programme must have impressed you a lot when you first saw it, to have switched to it. It must have impressed you a lot.
It did. It's a very exciting, dynamic program. And really, you are working at the front line of the criminal justice system. I'm program manager. So, I mean, I do get to see, it's the program lawyers who I'm working with. They're in and out of courts. They're in prisons, you know, seeing who's detained, who might need support, and then in and out of the police cells. So it is quite a hands-on job. And now, I don't know if we want to go down the COVID-19 route yet.
Just a little bit, maybe, but we'll go on first.
But I think we can really see the importance of the work through the lens of COVID-19, actually, and I have certainly seen that. Yeah, we can talk about that.
What I wanted to ask you was, because when we were in touch, you were entering lockdown. We were we were on the phone, and you were saying, "Look, this is happening now, and I need to make sure that my lawyers can actually still move about, and I need to see what the situation is." And it struck me as like, and I went, and I know I'm wondering what time Aldi is open at. You know, how spoiled am I sitting where I am? Has the epidemic really brought into sharp focus, as it has for many, the gaps of the haves and have nots, I suppose?
100%. And when I hear my family and friends in Ireland, and then in comparison to Malawi, it's such a dichotomy. Mm. I mean, it's always a dichotomy anyway, but I think this really does bring it into focus. Malawi registered its first COVID-19 case at the beginning of April. So, I mean, later in the trajectory than other countries, really. Mm. And even within Africa, because it was one of the last countries to in Africa to have confirmed cases. Now, that, I mean, I'm not an expert on COVID-19 or anything.
We're not all epidemiologists here, you know.
Exactly. But I mean, that's really as a result of the capacity to test. Mm. So, I mean, at the moment now, there's 36 confirmed cases and 3 deaths. But in general, I think the trajectory of COVID-19 in African countries seems to be a little bit different. Certainly, and again, I'm not an expert, but like just looking at kind of how it has moved, and it seems to be at a slower pace, and potentially could, you know, get quickened, and the number of deaths has been lower. But I think the issue in Malawi and other countries such as Malawi, issue is the impact that it could have on a, you know, it will cripple an already really struggling health system. and all a country that's, you know, already poor. And we know from Ireland's, you know, the effect that it has on the economy. So then imagine putting that in an already struggling economy and a population that is so poor. Mm. And they already have so many different, like, health crises, you know, high levels of TB, of HIV, of malnutrition, and already the health system can't cope. And then the health infrastructure with the number of ventilators and all of that is so low. So I suppose the risk of it having such a serious impact. Mm. And it's funny you should say about the going into lockdown. And I was running around trying to get permits and so that we could continue, I suppose, really what's humanitarian access, you know. Mm. We'll go into what that looks like for Irish rule of law. It's very different to food distributions and different things that would be done. But so I don't know what day it was that we were speaking, but the next, and I was running around getting the permits, and the next day, no, not even the next day, within a few hours of that, and the lockdown was supposed to be the next day, and that evening, a human rights organization filed an injunction against the lockdown. And this was because they felt that it wasn't well planned, it wasn't well communicated, and the impact of a lockdown in Malawi would be so significant if it isn't well planned. And I think there's been a lot of discussion now about what a lockdown means in countries in Europe or in the US yeah. versus a lockdown in Africa. And it comes back to that point actually that you made around the kind of like one size fits all, or here's a solution. Mm. Oh, let's bring that to Africa. And it doesn't really work. I mean, there has been, so it's not a lockdown, but the schools have been shut, bars, restaurants, the formal sector is working from home. But 80%, if I'm not mistaken, of the Malawi economy is informal.
Okay.
So you can't, how do you do a lockdown for the informal sector? Yeah. And people in Malawi, they live, I mean, the phrase hand to mouth, I mean, sounds like, but it's literally hand to mouth. You know, Malawians will go out and they might work the field or work, you know, maybe cleaning someone's house, work in a market, and they would literally earn money to buy food for that day. Mm. So, I mean, Malawians don't have the privilege that we would in the sense of being able to bulk buy and then being able to stay indoors. So there does need to be a tailored solution for Malawi and for African countries. So there could be a lockdown pending, but we just are yet to hear the result of the hearing for the injunction, which I think is imminent any day, if not today or tomorrow. Yeah.
Okay.
Is there any social structure in place for the very basics just to feed people through a lockdown, or is it just everybody has to take care of themselves?
I mean, that's what the Malawi government and non-governmental organizations and the international community is working on at the moment in order to bring in those social supports that wouldn't necessarily be there. There is a very small... A lot of it would be the international community kind of coming in on a day-to-day basis for this support. But the government, they are working on, even if you just think of like support for agriculture and supporting farmers and helping them be more productive. There is a small social cash transfer to the very bottom 10% of the poor. That's also mainly supported by the international community. So there are structures there, but very limited, and it's more acute within a pandemic.
Yeah.
Now, in saying that, Malawi has faced many, many emergencies and disasters, floods, drought, you know, so, and that's on a cyclical, nearly maybe every year, every 2 years, going from flood to drought. So they're able to like jolt into this is an emergency. And all of the different government departments will come together and the international community will come together to address that. This is slightly different and it is a bit of a different focus. And for us, we can see then how the justice sector and prisons then actually get impacted, whereas they wouldn't normally be impacted by floods or a drought, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting time in Malawi. Time will tell whether the numbers increase and the impact that will have and the impact that a potential lockdown could have, because people would be scared of dying of hunger, in a lockdown, never mind dying of COVID-19,
In a country where over 50% of people are well below the poverty line as it is, according to statistics, then you're already, by definition, probably suffering forms of deprivation, be it, hunger and not being able to clothe and all those simple things, light, heat, all of those things.
Yeah, water, access to water,
That we take for granted, that I take for granted anyway. Just in terms of, you mentioned there the humanitarian aspect of what you guys can do. What does that mean in terms of how we are, the vista that we're facing today?
Yeah, I mean, the work that Irish Rule of Law is doing and then a COVID-19 response is primarily focused on prisons.
Mm.
Because in prison, if there was an outbreak, it would be, it's not really worth thinking about. And I suppose the way I can kind of, maybe if I can describe the prison conditions, and that might give a picture of the risks involved if there is, and there's a very real potential of an outbreak in the prisons. The word overcrowded just doesn't even describe it, but it is the words that we use. Oh, Malawi prisons are very overcrowded.
Mm.
If I try and put a figure on that, on average, Malawi prisons are 260% over capacity.
Okay.
260% over capacity. So that's a lot of prisoners in a very small space. And that small space is also very basic. The cells are just like concrete walls. Mm. And there is little pegs for the individual's belongings that are up on around the wall. Mm. And then, there's no mattresses. Or very few mattresses in most prisons, particularly when you're looking at that level of overcrowding. And so when prisoners go to sleep, they're literally sleeping on top of each other, head to toe, head to toe, head to toe. There's no option. You can't social distance. You just can't. Access to sanitation,
Yeah, so basically,
prisoners wouldn't have soap.
It's beyond Dickensian, and it's well into the terms of that if a pandemic was to get in, there could be no stopping it.
There could be no stopping it. And so if we look at other infectious diseases within prison settings, TB, according to the WHO, spread, the infection rate of TB in prisons is 81 times higher in prisons than the general population. HIV would be 50%, the infection rate would be 50% higher in prisons than the general population. So if you then extrapolate that and put that to COVID-19, you can see the risk.
Mm.
Hundreds, if not thousands, would die because the rate of, in Malawi in particular, there's already existing infectious diseases, a very high rate of TB and other respiratory diseases, and a high rate of HIV and malnutrition. So the individuals that go in there, some of them might have a life sentence, but that is not, it's really a death sentence in there. For many of them. So, and I think what people forget also is that prisons aren't in isolation. There is prison staff going in and out. There's visitors, which I'll also get to because there's also vulnerability around lockdowns for prisoners. And because of that movement in and out, and there's new remandees going into the prison and then people being let out. So the risk to the broader community as well is huge. So, and like the prisons would be in, like, one of the prisons, the main prison in the capital here in Lilongwe, is right bang smack in the middle of a residential area.
Right.
So if people really thought, because some people are, I'll just lock away the key, they don't, you know, do the prisoners matter? That concept, it's like, oh, well, they did something wrong, which also, yeah, I could get into that. And the
it's a whole other story.
Potential innocent people that could be considering the Malawi context. So it's, and that's part of our work, basically, is two different things. One is advocating for decongestion of prisons, along with many other organizations. Mm. And then also ensuring that there's preventative measures within the prisons themselves, so that there is hand washing facilities and soap available, both for the prisoners and for the prison staff, and that there's PPE equipment for the prison staff and access to masks, and potentially like isolation centres and training for the staff in prisons so that they can actually deal with this.
It seems to be coming from a long way behind in the prison system. A lot to do very quickly to ensure that COVID doesn't get in and run rampant in the prisons. Have they attempted to do anything like we've done here and release some prisoners to try and at least thin down the numbers a little?
Yes, they have. Now, as civil society and non-governmental organizations, our line is, we need to do more, which we do, but there has been small numbers kind of trickling. I mean, what ideally we would like is kind of like, well, I mean, that sounds a bit scary, a mass release, but, you know, a release in the thousands and that could be done maybe through a pardon by the president. That's generally the way that it would be done in other African countries. And this would be focused on, you know, those who've committed very minor offences, those who are maybe at the end of their sentence, those who are sick, particularly like the elderly, and what other, then like women with children in prison, because that's quite common here. So there would be certain categories that we would say, these are the categories that we would like to be released through a pardon or through other measures where you would have like a large number released. So that's what we have been pushing. And the government has, the president did announce in one of his COVID-19 briefings that's what they want to do. It's just a bit of a slow process and it's a bit political as well. But we have also been working at kind of, and this is the work that we do on a, I suppose, daily basis, would be because the resources in Malawi within the justice system are so little, it can be difficult. You know, there's not enough judges, there's not enough magistrates, not enough lawyers. It can be difficult to transport prisoners from one place to another. So we try to kind of fast track that process by bringing, basically, it's kind of like a mobile court. And we bring the magistrate, the court clerk, the police prosecutors, the lawyers to the prisons. And so they can see a large number of prisoners.
Yeah.
So they have been, like, I suppose, ramped up significantly in order to release as many. Because you'll have many who, remandees who, you know, might be sitting there for a long time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, waiting to be, like, officially charged and then for a trial. And that whole process can take a lot of time. So we would then be working with the judiciary and all the rest of the players to bring that process along much quicker. So that has been releasing prisoners. And also there's a body called the Inspectorate of Prisons, and that's made up of lots of different kind of stakeholders. And they have been doing prison visits around the country, and they have recently released around 1,300 from those prison visits. So that's it's a start. I mean, people are saying even if you could just get the prisons to capacity, but even to get prisons to capacity, you're releasing quite a large number, and you have to, you know, you have to balance that also with the interests of the public and all of that. So we wouldn't be advocating just release everybody, and so like
You
know, it's certain categories of, you know, non-violent minor offenders and those who are exceptionally vulnerable.
Yeah, I just think, you know, you've just given a great account of some of the most important work that people can be doing and what it actually means logistics-wise. Because we always say, people say to us, like, about solutions to problems, it's about taking away the barriers, the restrictions, and by bringing people and moving those to, and, you know, making it as smooth a process. I hate to say so economically, like a conveyor belt almost, where you try to do it, but that's what you're trying to do. That's terrific work, and I think it's a great praise to you and the team that are out there that people are doing this, and I'm glad that our listeners will get an idea of that. It really, I'm pretty impressed anyway. Martin, have you?
Yeah, no, I think the work that you do, I think the dedication. When I think that you could be over here, you could be a nice defense lawyer. You're driving a nice sports car, living a nice life, but you know you choose the better path, and it really is. It's heartening to see people do that. It really is heartening to see people do that.
I will say one last thing for the listeners: you can just go to irishruleoflaw.ie, and there is a donate section. So if you do want to put your hands in your pocket, it's a great cause. irishruleoflaw.ie. We'll put the details on the podcast when it comes out. But you know, there's a donate window there, guys. It's not too hard. We all know how to do it these days. So a couple of quid, it's money well spent. Shona, Dylan,
thank you very much. Here, here.
We really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for the work you do, and best of luck and stay safe.
Yes,
Shona, and it looks like you love where you are, and I think that shines through really well. Is that you absolutely love where you are?
I do. Ireland also has a bit of a shine in my heart, but the work I do here, yeah, it's great. And can I just say kudos to Echo Chamber and just the great, it was only recently that I heard about you, and yeah, it's a great voice and a different voice within Ireland's media, so well done.
Different is true. Talk to you all soon, folks.